Hello, everyone. Thank you for coming. My name is Ryan Copemans. I'm an associate at Nyemaster Good and a vice president for the Iowa Lawyers Chapter of the Federalist Society. For those of you who don't know much about the Federalist Society, we're a group of lawyers, judges, and law students who promote the debate of the rule of law. And contrary to some belief, we are not a secret society. We do not have secret handshakes that I know of, and we have no plan to conquer the world, at least as of yet. What we're trying to do is, like what we're doing here tonight, is to bring people together of different viewpoints and talk about interesting legal topics. And I think we have a great panel for you tonight on a very interesting and timely topic. We started discussing back in December about what kind of events we could put on, and with the detainees possibly moving to just right outside of our border, we thought this would be an excellent topic. And obviously since December, the topic has stayed in the news and become even more relevant. So introduce our panel here. Our moderator for this evening is Judge Larry Eisenhower of the Iowa Court of Appeals. Judge Eisenhower was appointed to the Iowa Court of Appeals after serving as a district court judge for 7 years. In 2005, he took a leave from the court to serve as an international judge for the United Nations mission in Kosovo. In that capacity, Judge Eisenhower presided over cases dealing with human trafficking and rape, and he also served as an investigating judge in a terrorism case. Judge Eisenhower received his bachelor's degree from Emporia State University and his JD from the Drake University of Law School. Before law school, he also served for 2 years in the United States Army. Our first speaker tonight is Michael Edney. Michael Edney is of counsel in the Washington, D.C. office of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher, where he practices in criminal and regulatory defense, complex civil litigation, and appellate and constitutional law. From 2007 to 2009, Mr. Edney served as the legal advisor to the National Security Council at the White House, where he provided legal advice on national security-related issues, including the legal response to the Supreme Court's 2006 decision in Hamdan v. Rumsfeld, and on the drafting of the Military Commissions Act of 2006. Last summer, Mr. Edney testified before Congress on this exact topic in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee. An Omaha, Nebraska native, so he is used to these Iowa winters, Mr. Edney received his bachelor's degree from the University of Notre Dame and his JD from the University of Chicago. He was a law clerk to the Honorable Danny J. Boggs, Chief Judge of the United States Court of Appeals for the Sixth Circuit. Our second speaker tonight is Angela Campbell. Ms. Campbell is a co-founder of the Dickey and Campbell Law Firm, where she practices in criminal law, immigration, civil rights, and personal injury, among other things. From 2003 to 2007, she served as an assistant federal public defender in Des Moines. In that capacity, Ms. Campbell served as counsel to four Guantanamo detainees in 2007. In addition to her private practice, Ms. Campbell teaches federal criminal law and terrorism in the law at the Drake Law School. Also a native of Nebraska, Ms. Campbell received a bachelor's degree from Yale University and her JD from Boston College Law School. After law school, she served as a law clerk to the Honorable Arlen Beam of the United States Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. We welcome all of you, and we thank you very much for coming.
Is Judge Mansfield here? There he is. He suggested that I put my notes on my hand, but I decided not to do that. Well, we do have a very interesting topic tonight, and he's indicated that we're going to have speakers, but I think we're going to try to make this relatively interactive, and we've had a conference call, and we've got a little direction, but we'll see where it goes. It could be very interesting. Just some opening remarks to kind of set the stage for the topic and the discussion here. In every armed conflict, there are always people that are captured. And the question that's historically followed those armed conflicts is, what are we going to do with them now? Traditionally, you have armed armies that face each other. They're in uniform. They're captured. They fight. They try to kill each other. That's what their goal is. But those are not crimes. Those are not war crimes. That's considered to be legitimate combat. They're captured. They're held. We held a bunch of them up in Algona during World War II, some of you know. There was a huge prisoner of war camp up there. But rarely has this question become as tangled as after the fate of those who have been detained since September the 11th. And I'm going to give you just a real quick historical take on some of the legislative actions, some of the administration's actions, both the current administration and the past administration, and some of the significant legal cases that have led to up to where we are today. In 2002, immediately after the reports, the administration declared that many of these detainees, particularly those suspected of Al-Qaeda links, were, quote, unlawful combatants. And since they were not members of a legitimate national armed force, the administration said the protections accorded by the Geneva Conventions did not apply. A special detention facility was set up at Guantanamo Bay and to hold several hundred detainees, most of whom had been captured during the war in Afghanistan in 2001. The administration asserted that the legal status of the detainees was a matter for the executive branch to determine, putting the prisoners beyond the review of federal courts. In 2004, the Supreme Court disagreed in Rasul versus Bush, holding that the federal habeas statute conferred jurisdiction to hear challenges to those detainees being held to the detention at Guantanamo Bay. In 2006, the Supreme Court ruled in Hamdan versus Rumsfeld that in general striking down the existing system of military commissions. Congress responded by passing the Military Commissions Act of 2006. You've heard in Mr. Edney's introduction that he may have had something to do with that act. The new law not only authorized the military commissions, but attempted to strip the federal courts of jurisdiction to hear habeas actions of foreigners held as enemy combatants at Guantanamo Bay. In June 2008, Boumediene versus Bush, the Supreme Court overturned the portions of the Military Commissions Act of 2006, finding that foreign terrorism suspects had a constitutional right that they could challenge their detention in the United States courts. Among the first acts of President Obama when he became president was to set a deadline to close the Guantanamo Bay detention facility by January 22nd of this year. That date has come and gone, and the facility is still there. He also issued an immediate halt to the military commission proceedings for prosecuting detainees and filed a request in the Federal District Court for District of Columbia to stay any habeas proceedings there. The Justice Department issued an opinion that it would abandon the term enemy combatant, and it also argued that the president has the authority to detain terrorism suspects without criminal charges. It provided a broad definition of those who could be held, which was not significantly different from the previous administration. In May of 2009, Mr. Obama said military commissions would be used as one avenue for prosecution of detainees along with the federal courts. In a speech on May 21st, President Obama classified the remaining detainees at Guantanamo Bay in five different categories. First of all, those who have violated American criminal laws, and he said they should be tried in the federal courts. Secondly, those detainees who violate the laws of war and are best tried before military tribunals. Third, those who have been ordered released by the courts. There have been continuous series of habeas corpus proceedings in the federal courts in the District of Columbia, and as of December, 32 detainees have been ordered released by the federal courts. The fourth category involves detainees who have determined can be transferred safely to another country. As recently as last week, Spain agreed to take five detainees. And finally, according to the president, there remains the question of detainees at Guantanamo who cannot be prosecuted, yet who pose a clear danger to the American people. In November, last November, 2009, the Attorney General announced that five detainees would face a military commission and five others, including Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, would be prosecuted in the federal court in New York City. And you're probably aware of the brouhaha that's arisen since that's been suggested. Most significant recent discussion of the detainees that are at Guantanamo currently, on January 22nd, the Justice Department Task Force concluded that of the nearly 200 detainees left at the center, Close to 50 will be held indefinitely because they are considered too difficult to prosecute but too dangerous to release. Nearly 40 other detainees should be prosecuted for terrorism or other war crimes, and the remaining prisoners, about 110, should be repatriated or transferred to another jurisdiction. Many questions remain of the roughly 110 that the Justice Department suggested should be transferred. About 30 are Yemenis, and the administration recently halted transfers to Yemen in the wake of the attempted bombing of an airplane on Christmas Day. So with that background, I think we should allow our guests from the District of Columbia to tell us what he thinks we ought to do with these people.
Take all the time.
Hi. Well, Ryan didn't tell you that he was engaging in a little bit of self-dealing when he invited me to come here, because he worked back with us at Gibson Dunn in Washington, D.C. He was the best lawyer that we had, and you guys should hire him. There's some self-dealing for you. I would imagine that there's some interest here in the approximately 196 soon-to-be neighbors that you're about to get. When I was on the plane here, I did some back-of-the-envelope calculations. I think you'll be pleased to know that there are 10 fewer detainees at Guantanamo than there are miles between Des Moines and Thompson, Illinois. That maybe provides some comfort. I thought there might be a detainee per mile, but that's not the case. Closing Guantanamo is one aspect of what has been a very intense and passionate public debate about what to do with suspected al-Qaeda and Taliban fighters and terrorists in our armed conflict with those entities. For all the public commentary and discussion and criticism, the amazing thing is the remarkable amount of consensus between the Obama administration and the immediately previous administration, the Bush administration. I think it's really quite remarkable. And there's four things that stand out. I think both administrations agree that al-Qaeda and the Taliban are threats to the American people. I think they both agree that the use of military force, lethal military force, against these entities and their associates is wholly legal, authorized, and justified. I think that both administrations agree that military commissions are necessary and appropriate for trying these people for violations of the law of war. And it took the President a while to say this out loud, but both administrations are firmly of the belief, apparently, that we are at war with these entities. Took them until May 15, 2009, but it's an important recognition, and it drives a lot of the conclusions about what we do next in this area. There are some things that the two administrations disagree on, and I think where the current administration has gotten into trouble is by not following those four principles to their logical conclusion and compromising on some of the hot-button issues of the day. On what to do with these people with regard to trial, the administration has decided, as Judge Eisenhower explained, to try some of them in federal court in New York. I guess it's not New York now. It's some island in New York Harbor, or it's some air base in upstate New York, or it's someplace else. They keep changing their mind. But try them in some federal court someplace, and try some of them by military commission. Now, the Obama administration says that the way they'll decide between these two options is to review the cases carefully and sort them between the two systems on the basis of the strength of evidence. I think that this is the worst of all possible decisions. I almost wish, although I feel very fond of it, I almost wish they had dumped the military commission system entirely, because that will be the end result of this process. What the Obama administration is essentially telling the appellate courts and the country is that they will try suspected members of al-Qaeda by federal court when the evidence is strong enough, and when the procedures won't make a difference. And when they do, they'll shift them over to military commissions, which they are signaling to all of us is a weaker form of justice that is less preferred. It's the system which they don't have a presumption for. And that is not a message to anybody, reviewing courts, to the world, that military commissions are justified for these circumstances. I think, as we'll talk about a little bit later, I think they are justified for the special circumstances of trying members of a foreign enemy corps during the continuing armed conflict. Second, the second compromise, I think, has been closing Guantanamo. Now, they came right out of the gate very early on January 22nd and issued an executive order saying that this should be done. But it raises a lot more questions than it answers. You know, why does the press, why does the world have such a fixation on Guantanamo Bay? There are, I don't have a completely accurate count of this, but I think there are more than 1,000 individuals today who are held at Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan, which is a subject that you don't hear very much about, that has been subject to almost no media and certainly no judicial scrutiny. The one case that tried to do something about it was promptly dismissed. There are many more that are killed on a continuing basis through the use of lethal military operations in Afghanistan, and I guess the press reports now in certain regions of Pakistan. These decisions are made by the executive branch. They are not subject to judicial review. There is no scrutiny into what standards are used to make these decisions. But instead, we spend a lot of time thinking about, well, are we going to make the United States government prove beyond a reasonable doubt, for example, whether people should be held at Guantanamo Bay? I would think that most of the people at Guantanamo Bay would rather be detained than dead, but we're spending a lot more time on the decision whether to continue to hold them than to use lethal military force against people like them that are similarly situated. It's an oddity. Another question is, why are we bringing them to the United States, of all places? You know, people say, well, why did we have this Guantanamo thing? And one of the answers is that there are a lot more difficult legal principles that apply once you bring people to the United States. The Supreme Court has suggested, if not held, that the most substantive provisions of the Constitution apply to U.S. citizens in the United States and abroad, and to aliens while they are within the territorial United States. Well, nobody has spent a lot of time, certainly not this administration, thinking about what should be done when they get to the United States. How will we be able to justify their detention once they are here, and when they have the full panoply of constitutional rights that are afforded to all of us? It's very difficult to satisfy those standards, especially with the exigencies of gathering evidence during the time of armed conflict. In my view, it's the height of irresponsibility for the administration to seek to move these folks to the United States without having the Congress and even itself have a comprehensive plan for how they're going to prove and justify their detention under the full constitutional standards that apply within this country, not at Guantanamo. And if you go back, embedded in Judge Eisenhower's description of the historical background here is a walk through the Supreme Court cases. The last Supreme Court case to comment on this question held that one small part of the Constitution, the suspension clause, applies at Guantanamo Bay largely because of its link to certain territories that the British Empire had before 1789. No court, not the Supreme Court, not any other court, has held that these folks have constitutional rights down at Guantanamo Bay beyond the suspension clause, the due process clause, the confrontation clause, the double jeopardy clause. Nobody has considered this question. It's a crucially important question to sort out, and you can't just punt it to the courts. If you're responsible for the national security of this country, you can't just say, well, we'll just let the courts figure it out, and I'm not going to propose any standards in advance for dealing with this. So as I say, there's more questions now today than there are answers with this new approach. I think that the new administration, I'm going to be completely candid with you, is finding that these issues are a little bit harder than they thought. Like, they're surprised to know that the Bush administration wasn't just holding these people down at Guantanamo Bay for fun. As it turns out, the Bush administration had released almost 80% of the people that held at Guantanamo Bay. And I think the administration found that that when it looked at the cases of the people who were left, they really were the dangerous ones, and they're difficult to deal with. There aren't any easy answers. If you wanted the return to where I started, if you wanted a prediction about whether you are going to have 196 or 150 or 100 new neighbors in the near future, my answer to that question is no. I do not think that before the next presidential election they will move Guantanamo detainees to the United States without a specific and filibuster-proof ratification of this policy choice by the United States Congress. I think it's too politically costly at this point. I do not think that will happen. And so if anybody's staying up at night thinking about this, I think you can sleep soundly. I don't think that it's going to occur. Look forward to the questions and the debate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Edney, and thank you, Judge. I think I was chosen to debate Mr. Edney because everyone's pretty sure that I'm going to disagree with everything he says. And that's what my job is to do today, is to disagree.
Steal your pen, by the way.
That's fine. I don't need a pen. I'm going to start with the premise that we're going to discuss what we do now. I mean, I think we could debate forever about whether what happened in the past was appropriate or legal or the best policy. But what do we do now, knowing what we know now? And I don't think there'll be any disagreement that the military commissions and the attempt to use military commissions so far have not worked. They are not successful. We have been through three prosecutions in 8 years, and they simply aren't working. Now, knowing that, we are then presented with the question of what do we do with people who have committed crimes against the United States, whether it be foreign terrorism or domestic terrorism? What do we do with them? And I think that we have three options that we will be presented with. And if there's anything that Mr. Edney and I will agree on, the third option is going to be the most difficult. The first option is put them all, everyone we possibly can, into the military commission structure. The second option is if they've committed some sort of crime against the United States, whether it's on foreign soil or on the U.S. soil, whether they conspired overseas or they came over here, no matter what the circumstances, put as many people as possible into federal criminal court in the United States. And then the third option is some sort of compromise. Now, I said that Mr. Edney and I were going to agree about one thing, and that is that compromise is going to be extremely difficult. Now, I am under the impression that Mr. Edney is going to say that he would think in that circumstance that we will that we should choose military commissions. And I'm going to argue in this debate that we should choose federal criminal prosecutions over either a compromise or a use of the military commissions. Now, I don't think there's any debate that we could use military commissions, that they're legal, that they have a history in this country, that there are processes already established throughout the court's jurisprudence that involves military commissions, that we could use that system. I don't think there's any debate. I think the question is, what should we do? And what I think we should do is that we should demonstrate to this world, that we should demonstrate to all of these countries, that we can convict criminals under our own system, under our own protections. If there's anything that the United States does great, it is prosecute and detain criminals. We do a great job at it, and we already have a system set up to handle it. Why do we keep trying to create a new system and another new system and another new system to address an issue that we could just address with the current system? And so I'm going to open it up now to our debate, just so that you know that that's my position. We should be focusing all of these people through the federal criminal justice system.
Well, we've raised a couple of issues. We're primarily talking about current detainees at Guantanamo. One of the things we haven't talked about, and maybe we should touch on this a little bit, there's an extraordinary number of alleged terrorists, in the broadest sense of the term, who have been tried and convicted in the federal courts. They're doing time and have been convicted. There was a guilty plea today in federal court in New York, and one of the fellows who was accused of plotting to blow up the New York subway system. And he was originally, I believe, from Pakistan or Afghanistan. So you have a problem with trying other than Guantanamo defendants, like the guy who's pled today, or like Richard Reed, or like some folks in the federal court.
Me?
Yeah.
I think one of the key difference between the folks that we have tried, if I have to use this.
One of the key differences between the folks that we have tried here and in federal court and the folks that we have sought to try in military commissions is that they were captured inside the United States. Why haven't more of those people been funneled into the military commission process? It's right that only two people captured inside the United States have been put in military custody. That was during the Bush administration. The remainder were sent directly into the federal criminal process. I think that that's a much more difficult question than alien enemy combatants captured abroad. One of the reasons that I think that has happened is because of fear of legal challenges. Angela was right that the military commission process hasn't been churning out convictions exactly. Maybe it was poorly constructed. I don't think so. But maybe it was wrapped up in extensive and protracted, and I think inappropriate judicial challenges. Not inappropriate in the lawyers that brought them, but perhaps more inappropriate than the courts that entertained them at the time that they did. I always thought it was very remarkable that courts entertained these facial challenges to military commission procedures without actually seeing how they worked in the particular case and whether any particular complaints about those procedures worked a injustice or a violation of constitutional rights in the particular case. They were challenged in the abstract, and I think it's hard to decide cases in that context. But I think that the administration, to some degree, has been, the Bush administration certainly was, and this administration actually probably believes in it, was cowed into using the federal criminal process for these individuals because they were fearful of litigation results. Let me back up from all that. One question that this naturally brings to mind is what should have been done or should be done with the Northwest 253 Christmas bomber, underwear bomber. I can't pronounce his name.
That was my next question.
Yeah, how do you pronounce his name?
I mean, I
Umar Farouk Abdul Muttalib.
Right. Say that 10 times in a row. Yeah. I think that the debate over him is more properly aimed at how he was treated before he was injected into the federal criminal process, rather than whether he's ultimately brought to justice within an Article III court. The man was Mirandized 50 minutes after he was captured, or 50 minutes after questioning started. There's probably some prosecutors in this room. I'm not sure that the case against that gentleman would have been difficult to prove, given the fact that you had the entire manifest of an Airbus 330 to testify against him. I don't think it was all that ambiguous as to what he was up to. I don't think that we needed him to testify against himself or to give an incriminating statement in order to seal up that case. I think what happened there instead was that we cut off a important intelligence opportunity in the context of a fresh threat in blind pursuit of a principle that I don't think really should apply in this context of war, which is, well, we Mirandize everybody that we capture. Well, when he's a member of an enemy armed force during a time of armed conflict, maybe that's not the correct policy. I think that people could very reasonably say that if we're going to have a military commission system,
it should be reserved for aliens that we capture outside the United States. And if that principle were applied, Mr. Abu Muttalib would be in federal criminal courts and Mr. Osama bin Laden would not. I think that you could expand that principle to say that military commissions should be used for people inside the United States. It raises different policy issues that I can discuss in further detail. But it's a, I don't know that that dividing line is the beginning or the end of the debate. It's the one that's generally been used at this point.
I don't know where to start. Okay. First, I'm going to address his comments that we should have a dividing line at all. The implication is that if we're dealing with an enemy combatant or someone who has ties to Al-Qaeda or to the Taliban, whether they're in the United States or not, they are most appropriately tried in the military commissions. The problem with that is that it involves a factual finding prior to a determination of what system you're going to submit the person to. And if you then have different rules involving the different systems, like, for example, whether or not you are going to use Miranda or not, or whether or not hearsay is admissible, if the rules are different and there's a factual determination that has to be made before you determine whether someone is put into one process or the other, it creates all sorts of procedural problems and procedural hurdles. Now, I would agree that the controversy over the Military Commissions Act was not necessarily all based on the drafting of the act. But the problem is when you have a new system and you have new rules and you have new processes and you're trying to create an entire new system of justice, you're going to have lawyers that are going to challenge that. And what are they going to challenge it with? They're going to challenge it with a comparison to the U.S. system. So as long as we're going to be comparing the Military Commissions Act to the U.S. system and be criticizing it in comparison to the U.S. system, why can't we just show the world that we can still convict these people using the U.S. system? Give them all the constitutional rights. Give them their due process rights. Give them the Miranda warnings. And I guarantee you, you're still going to convict terrorists in that system. And you're going to do it much faster, much more efficiently. And you're not going to give we defense lawyers a heyday in challenging every new rule that you are going to pass with the Military Commissions Act. And so that's why I think that it would be better placed putting them in federal criminal court. Absent some sort of reason why they can't be put in criminal court, I think it would just be a smarter and easier system to just use the one that we already have set up. As to giving Miranda warnings to whatever his name is, the Christmas Day bomber, obviously there was a lot of debate about whether or not he should or shouldn't have gotten his Miranda warnings, whether he got them quick enough or he should have never got them at all. I think that debate is just sort of misplaced. They're going to convict him whether or not they use his confession or not. He was on a plane with a bomb strapped to him and he lit himself on fire. So if any good prosecutor can convict that person without the use of his confession. What then happens is the law enforcement needs to know what they're dealing with. They need to know if they're going to be using Miranda or not, if they're going to be using military commissions or the federal criminal system or not. And they need to know that so that they can make a decision whether or not they're going to follow certain processes or not. And so I think the greatest travesty in that whole situation was that law enforcement sort of got put in a position where they were arguing with each other about appropriate treatment of this person that just tried to blow up a plane. And it's putting too much focus on law enforcement's decision when they haven't had clear guidance on what process they're supposed to be using in these circumstances. So I think that we need to provide them that process.
Please, yes.
I don't want to prolong this too long, but I'll say three short things about that. First, this concern about there having to be a factual determination beforehand that somebody is an unlawful enemy combatant. That determination needs to be by the executive branch, and we don't have procedures for that. I mean, I do think that it's very odd that very determination, matter of fact, probably one that's much less rigorous than that, is responsible for much more serious things than the prosecution of our war against terror. It's responsible, for example,
for military targeting decisions that resolves not only in the end of the individual's liberty, but the end of his life. And to say that for some reason the executive branch is incapable of doing that, or they're doing a bad job, or we shouldn't rely on it, is really a broader indictment about the way that we prosecute military conflicts in this country, rather than a question about our criminal justice system. You know, I suppose that the military commission system invites a comparison to the U.S. criminal justice system. I always wondered why the legality of the military commission system wasn't resolved by a comparison to the justice system for enemy members of the enemy in previous armed conflicts the United States was involved in. The Bush administration didn't make military commissions up. Military commissions were used in World War II. They were used in the Revolutionary War. They're used in almost every foreign armed conflict that the United States has been involved in to try individuals who weren't regarded as prisoners of war, even certain members of the enemy who were regarded as prisoners of war. And that the use of that system was upheld on every occasion, and it always had special procedures to deal with the exigencies of being in a continuing armed conflict. That is, protecting the information that is the basis for the decision from excessive public distribution and perhaps dissemination to the enemy force, and the destruction of intelligence sources and methods they're being used to protect the country, to protect our soldiers in the field. The U.S. criminal justice system is very good at convicting people. It's also very good at acquitting people. And that risk needs to be weighed when deciding between the two. Now you may say, well, geez, if he's acquitted, shouldn't he be at liberty? I don't know that that's right. I mean, the executive branch needs to make a variety of decisions about what information they're going to expose to the public and expose to the enemy, which is paying attention. We've seen it happen before. We saw it in the Blind Sheikh case, you know, before 9/11, at the first bombing of the World Trade Center. And every executive branch decision needs to be sensitive to those things. So I don't think it's just that simple to say that the criminal justice system has been great at throwing people in the clink. You know, it's funny, John Brennan, who's the president's counterterrorism advisor, said a week and a half ago or so that he thought that they were doing a great job down at Guantanamo and other places where they're holding these folks, because only 20% of the people who had been released by the executive branch's own decision, not thrown out by court, had returned to the fight against U.S. forces and terrorist acts against the American people. Some people might say that that's an intolerably high percentage, and that 20% is a little reckless with the lives of our brave members of the military who are fighting in Afghanistan and in other places, and is a little reckless with the net security of this country during a time of war.
Angela, Mr. Edney raises the issue of not only the purpose of a basic criminal prosecution, that is to either convict or not convict a particular defendant, but this whole issue of protecting security and intelligence. In your representation of detainees at Guantanamo, how did that play out?
I had sort of a unique situation that none of mine were ever criminally charged, and we didn't have any habeas hearings, and we didn't have any classified information, and they didn't actually have any information about any of my guys that I was privy to. So that wouldn't have been a concern in the particular cases I worked on. I do understand the concern about handling classified information. The thing is that you would still have that concern with the military commissions. You're still going to have a concern of whether you let the press in, whether you give information to the defendants or not, whether you're going to allow hearsay, or you're just going to take the executive branch or the military or the CIA's word for it that this is the correct report and this is what was said on the battlefield. You're still going to have all those problems that you have to address with the military commissions. And what I fear that Mr. Edney is presenting is that these military commissions will be secret, will be more secret than a federal criminal trial could be. And that's a concern to me. If we weren't in the situation where we are now, where we have citizens of the United States and people outside of the country concerned about the legitimacy of the military commissions, then we need to address the secrecy issue. And there are systems set up to handle classified information within the federal criminal system. For those of you that practice federal criminal law, Rule 16 that governs the discovery of materials for a case is not very liberal, frankly. You don't always get all of the information. You don't always find out who the confidential source is. You don't always get all of the information that the government has about that particular defendant. And so there are procedures set up for handling that kind of information. And you also have the Classified Information Procedures Act. I understand that Mr. Edney doesn't think that that's probably sufficient enough to handle prosecutions in the United States.
Read my testimony.
I did read your testimony. It was really long. It took me forever. it was like a 160-page transcript or something.
No, it wasn't.
And I just think that if the problem is with dealing with classified information, then we need to address it for all criminal cases in the federal system, not just for these cases that are coming from Guantanamo or even from Bagram. I think we need to address it system-wide for the federal criminal system as well, because those same concerns could come up in a prosecution and a defense of someone that's held in the United States that's a citizen that's committed some sort of heinous terrorist act. So I would suggest that you could handle all of those concerns still within the federal criminal system.
Yeah, well, I probably disagree with that. I think that military commissions have special rules for dealing with classified information, which I think are manifestly fair and justified for the context of a continuing war against a foreign enemy force. And here's the way it works. All the evidence which is given to the members of the jury, essentially the members of the military who sit in the military commission, is shared with the defendant. There is a process by which for intelligence sources and methods underlying the evidence to be presented in the court. That can be presented in camera to a military judge who will make a determination of its reliability. And whether there is any part of that information that can be substituted or summarized in a manner that will protect the source of method, at the same time allow the defendant to get a very, very fulsome sense of the information that is the information that underlies the evidence that will be presented in court. At the same time, the government has a responsibility to turn over all exculpatory information, whether it's classified or not. And they can only withhold classified exculpatory information if they provide what the military judge deems to be an adequate substitute. So there are relatively strict rules, but there are procedures for it. And it is a good compromise, I think, that preserves some of the everyday intelligence activities that we're using to detect terrorist activities against the United States and to protect our troops in the field. Because Al-Qaeda listens to these trials, and when they figure out how the United States is eavesdropping on them, they turn off the things that are being detected. It's happened before. It will happen again. Does the federal court have anything to deal with this? The answer to that question is absolutely not. The Classified Information Procedures Act is an elaborate procedural mechanism that's designed to let the government make a choice in advance of trial about whether it wants to disclose the classified information that's at issue and material to the defense, or whether it wants to dismiss the case. It is possible, I'm not saying that's what happened in Angela's cases, but it is possible that the government made the decision that if it were up to it, knowing what it knew, it would continue to detain her clients, but it wasn't worth the risk of disclosing this classified information to the world in order to continue to detain them. And that's why she didn't receive any classified information. She just received a letter that they were on a plane home.
that decision for the government is one of the hardest it has to make. It's being made on a day-to-day basis. The Obama administration is making them. The Bush administration made it regularly, 700 times. And it is not exactly the decision that you want the government to have to make during the time of a continuing war. It's not in the interest of the security of the country. The Classified Information Procedures Act doesn't sort any of this out. Somebody has to. If we're going to use federal criminal trials, fine, but you know, Congress and the President just can't punt it to the courts and hope that they figure it out because it's really hard. They should develop procedures and rules for dealing with this. The nice thing about it is that the military commission process already has those. And that's, we need those modifications to deal with the context of a continuing war.
We need to leave a little time for questions, and I think we've got about 5 or 10 minutes left. And so, Jeff, you want to go first?
I really enjoyed this discussion. Regardless of which side you're on, whether you think it's enemy combatant, they stay in the commissions versus the criminal system, I think we'd all agree on, I don't know if you both saw Meet the Press a couple weeks ago with the Vice President, when he made the comment, they asked him, well, what happens if they're acquitted? And he said, well, they won't be acquitted. And I'm like, well, the whole purpose of this is to support the ideals of the American justice system, and yet you're prejudging they're already guilty, even though everybody thinks they are, for the most part. Not everybody, but a lot of people do. But why, you know, it just seems like that just cuts the legs out on the, you know, the very laudable goal that Angela is supporting of, you know, putting them through the American justice system. And yet it just seems like that kind of cuts the branch right off the tree. I'm just wondering, I mean, can it be one or the other? I mean, does it have to be a compromise, or does it all? I know you both said it probably a compromise isn't the way to go. Where do you think it's going to end up?
Well, every administration to look at the issue knows that it can't try every one of these people in federal court. Just cannot occur. They don't have the evidence to do it that meets up to the rigorous standards in federal court. Will not happen. So I think you're exactly right. I mean, the Justice Department has said as much in congressional testimony and in public statements. They won't be acquitted because we only brought the cases in federal court that have the strongest evidence. Well, maybe they will be convicted. I mean, I had no idea that Joe Biden was such an experienced trial lawyer, but I mean, it's possible that he's made this prediction and it's right. But
he made some comment too that even if they're convicted, we can still hold them.
Acquitted.
Yeah, that's interesting in its own way, right? I mean that's obviously, you know, it would lead somebody to ask the question, well, geez, what are we doing then, right?
We'll give them a fair trial and hang them later. That's right.
I mean, it seems to me that this compromise process that they've gone through risks the integrity of both systems of justice, right? It cheapens the federal criminal justice system because they're using it just as a little bit of political cover, right? And they're backloading all the hard cases into the military commission system, which both administrations think is absolutely necessary to deal with the bulk of the cases against these folks. And, you know, the Supreme Court decided a question very much like this in dealing with civil commitment versus criminal trials. You know, some clever states had said, well, geez, you know, if we can't convict them, we'll have a process where we hold them by a preponderance of the evidence if we prove their future dangerousness to a sufficient degree. And they said, well, no, you can't do that because it's not only that's a farce to some degree, but it cheapens the federal criminal justice system because those procedures and those rules, they don't matter until in the hard cases, right? And that's essentially what the administration is saying here. I think it's a weak compromise. It's not what the Constitution expects from a president during the time of war to make crisp, non-compromised decisions that protect the security of the United States.
I was concerned about the president's statements as well. I mean, I think the only, in my opinion, only legitimate way you hold someone without charges in this situation is if you declare that they're prisoners of war. And that hasn't happened so far. There are procedures under the Geneva Convention to deal with prisoners of war. You can hold them till the end of the conflict. That has a whole nother set of issues because we're at war with an idea, not at war with a person. So until the war on terror is over, we can hold people indefinitely. That has that causes me severe concern. But we can only address one issue at a time, and that issue is how do we legitimize these people that are legitimately, some of them may be dangerous? And we legitimize it by putting them through a process that works, that's been tested, that has hundreds of years of just criminal defendants and lawyers and scholars refining it to a point where we trust it. And the military commissions simply doesn't have that. I know that we have a history of military commissions during prior wars. Those don't apply. Those circumstances are completely different than the circumstances we find ourselves in now. And so we either recreate military commissions and make new rules, or we use the federal criminal system and we try to legitimize any conviction and continued detention of anybody that our administration thinks is dangerous.
But she just captured the essence of the debate there, because essentially everything that we've been talking about to this point is a debate about whether we're really at war or not, and whether the traditional authorities that apply in wartime for the first two centuries of this republic apply in this circumstance. I think that President Bush, I think even President Obama to some degree, is of the view that we have to have those authorities, that the 9/11 attacks was a strike at the heart of this country and needs to be repelled by military force, and they're doing it, right? And the legal apparatus that goes along with it also needs to apply, or else none of this makes any sense. None of this makes any sense. Down from the tanks firing, the soldiers shooting, the bombs dropping, none of it makes any sense unless you apply all of it.
Yeah, we when we met in advance of this discussion this evening, we decided to avoid that question because it is such a broad and has such implications. We were given the chart.
I guess I forgot that.
Well, no, but that's all right. Bring it up, because it is the essence of the real debate. We were kind of limited to what we're going to do with these detainees that are at Guantanamo now. We have other questions. We just have a few seconds left here, really. Anybody?
Why didn't the Bush administration try more of these folks in Guantanamo when he had a chance?
They tried.
Yeah, we tried, I guess. You know, I mean, it's most of it was in his introduction. I think if I remember correctly, when he set it up in 2002, it's almost immediately sued upon and enjoined, and it weaved its way up through our extremely fast, you know, justice system, from this district court to the D.C. Circuit to the Supreme Court, where it was finally determined to be statutorily illegal in 2006. We passed the Military Commissions Act very quickly thereafter, in October 2006, and the extremely short and unpleasant time period for me, at least. And then we started up that system again, charged a whole bunch of folks. Those prosecutions got hung up, and essentially awaited the Supreme Court's decision in Boumediene, which didn't really come until 2009. So it's essentially been hung up in a series of legal challenges. I know this sounds a little strange, but I actually think at the end of the administration it was about ready to completely cut loose, right? That, you know, we'd worked out a lot of the kinks, a lot of the ambiguities had been decided, all the legal challenges had more or less been cleared, and that the 9/11 conspirators case was about ready to go forward before it was suspended by the president in January 2009. I guess I made an error earlier when I said the median was decided in 2009. So that's the long answer. We tried, and we failed.
I think the short answer is that we tried a new system that hadn't been tested. We had new terminology, we had new processes, and we had a bunch of lawyers that didn't like how it was playing out, both on the prosecution side and the defense side. And so that just caused all sorts of delay, which again, to just throw in a pitch, wouldn't have happened if we just put them in federal criminal
court. Mr. Gwynn? Still the argument for the military tribunal, it sounds to me like it's based upon fear. You know, we're at war, war against whom, you know, there's this boogeyman out there and so on. I'd like to hear more about justice and less about fear.
Yeah, maybe. I don't think that it's based on fear. I mean, I don't think that a lot of people that work in the intelligence and military communities are afraid so much as they understand that there's a real threat and there's people that want to kill us and that they need to be stopped, and that the intelligence that they have against this enemy is the way by which they do it, and they want to be effective. And look, you know, I mean, the fact of the matter is that we're in a pretty serious armed conflict right now. And if really we think that Al-Qaeda, you know, is, you know, like the mob, right, you know, and should be all thrown in the clink and be prosecuted, then somebody needs to tell the president, the current president, to stop, you know, predator strikes and, you know, B-52 bombings and, you know, pull our troops out of Afghanistan who are shooting at them. Because that's what's happening right now. And a lot of the people who are making these decisions want to protect those troops and want to protect us here at home. I don't think the threat of Al-Qaeda is being overblown to one shred any further than it should be.
All right. One more.
Question for Ms. Campbell. As I hear your argument, you're not saying that military tribunals are necessarily unconstitutional. Your argument is more the impression that they would give toward the world is unfavorable and they're less practical. Is that right? Have I summed up?
Yes. Yeah, I mean, we can do it. The question is whether we should do it. And I'm saying, with our 8 years history of it not working, the world looking at us to set an example, these people that, frankly, they're not going to let go anyway, so why not just give them the most protections, the best system, give them the publicity so people can see what the evidence is and say, yeah, we should convict them, and we did. And then that would solve some of the problems. Now, it obviously won't solve all the problems, but I think it'll address some of the concerns.
Well, thank you very much. Oh, Daryl, you want one more?
I have one question. Could you detail the differences between the historical military commission regime and the system that's envisioned by the 2006 Act?
Well, it's been modified in 2009.
Yeah. So, 2009.
Yeah.
What are the primary differences between the military commission procedures used in World War II and the
I think the in a nutshell, the 2006 Act has a lot more and more robust procedures than the World War II and earlier commissions. Civil War, Mexican-American War commissions had. It really is a lot closer to a trial. It's really close. Actually, what's really close to is a general court-martial for members of the military. And if anybody thinks that that's a shortcut from a federal criminal trial, they're wrong. It's pretty seriously robust. It's a lot of ways more protective than a federal criminal trial. But there are a handful of modifications in there for classified information, for reliable hearsay evidence found by the military judge to be reliable, and a few others that were tailored to the exigencies of this particular armed conflict. I would say, it just as a kind of a broadside, if you compared the military commission procedures today to the ones that were used in Ex parte Quirin, for example, where you know, back in my old offices at the Justice Department, five Germans and four U.S. citizens were, I may be wrong on the numbers, were tried in a matter of 6 days and executed 3 days later, and the Supreme Court actually decided the case with a full opinion 3 months after they were dead, right? You know, I mean, that those procedures were nowhere near as hard as these, right? And so there's, if that's advancement, it's advanced quite a long way.
As a short answer, I mean, there's a reason why some members of the government want to use the military commissions, and that's because they get to use different evidence and more evidence that would be excluded in a federal criminal trial. The big difference is going to be the use of hearsay evidence. I think that's probably the biggest difference is what the procedures for determining the admissibility of out-of-court statements by someone who's not present in the court.
Well, that concludes our yes.
Where do they end up? Are they ultimately going back to Gitmo to stay there? I mean, they're not coming to Illinois.
Yeah, they are.
You think they're going?
They're not going to escape.
I know they're not going to escape, but are they going to stay?
No, they're not. Well, I don't know. I think they were supposed to be here
already,
3 weeks ago, right?
I don't think they're coming to Thompson, Illinois, folks. I wouldn't count on it. I think that the administration has figured out that it's screwed up and is going to reverse its decision and will never get the congressional support necessary for them to do it. I think they'll have to come up with Guantanamo is going to be the long-term detention facility for the folks that should be held out of the group. 196 that are there now.
Well, last May, the Senate took out $80 million out of the defense appropriation bill that was going to be used to transfer the prisoners from Guantanamo and actually put language in there that bars transferring detainees to United States soil. So it's going to be difficult.
I think it's illegal right now, actually, as it turns out. But
I think it's illegal to take them there to start with. So.
Should sue us.
Well, let's thank Mr. Edney and Mr. Campbell.